It's common knowledge amongst gamers that Nintendo protects its intellectual property rights with what we'll charitably call a heavy hand. And as you may be aware, I've talked about this topic a whole bunch already. We've discussed Nintendo taking down fan games and strategy guide scans and emulators, about Dolphin on Steam and Yuzu and the inevitable emulator whack-a-mole that we predicted together in the wake of Yuzu's demise. But throughout the past year of my explaining Nintendo's legal action against fan projects, there has been one exception that comes up in every comment section. One apparent outlier that, despite its prominence, seems to carefully avoid the long claw of Bowser's Law. And that outlier is Pokémon Showdown. Showdown is massively popular, and it is not an exaggeration to say that the competitive Pokémon scene wouldn't be nearly where it is today without it. But what is Pokémon Showdown, and how does Showdown not only survive, but thrive, in spite of Nintendo's notorious protectiveness? Is it even right to say that Pokémon is owned by Nintendo? Well, if you have the time to listen to me whine, we'll answer all of those questions together and more, and in doing so, we'll figure out exactly why Nintendo hasn't axed Pokémon Showdown. And if you're trying to avoid having your internet privacy axed, why not try out this video's sponsor, Surfshark VPN? Consider this. Imagine you are fighting in an OU tournament on Pokémon Showdown, and your opponent throws out a Belly Drum Azumarill. How do you stop this Azumarill from wiping your team? Well, you might throw out a Tapu Lele, whose ability Psychic Surge changes the terrain to Psychic Terrain, thus allowing Tapu Lele to outprioritize Aqua Jet and Revenge Kill the Azumarill. Surfshark is a VPN, a virtual private network, and like that Tapu Lele you threw out, when the privacy-compromising data-stealing Azumarill comes knocking at your door, you can turn the tables on it by switching the terrain. When you browse the internet unprotected, your data is constantly being harvested and your personal information is always at risk. Surfshark VPN is like a smokescreen, like Psychic Terrain, that hides your internet activity from would-be spies and snoopers by encrypting your data and connecting you securely to the internet. And the benefits of this might surprise you. You can slip around censorship. You can avoid nasty location-based price discrimination. You can use the public Wi-Fi at the airport or the coffee shop or the middle of nowhere without the fear of having your credit card information stolen or your device hacked. Connect to one of 3,200 servers in over 100 different locations. Plenty of options to make sure you're covered however you need to be against any metaphorical type disadvantage. And with Surfshark, you get more than just 6 slots. With one account, you can connect unlimited devices. Surfshark also offers antivirus software, data breach alerts, and more. So what are you waiting for? Is your internet privacy team going to be wiped, or are you going to secure your privacy with Surfshark VPN? Moon Channel viewers get a special offer. Go to surfshark.deals/moonchannel and enter code MOONCHANNEL for an extra 4 months free. That's surfshark.deals/moonchannel with coupon code MOONCHANNEL. A special thanks to Surfshark VPN for sponsoring this video. As any good lawyer should, let's start our discussion by defining our terms. What is Pokémon Showdown exactly, and why is it such a big deal? Well, Pokémon Showdown is a fully animated, web-based Pokémon battle simulator. It allows you to play Pokémon battles online against other battlers in real time, accurately simulating the Pokémon battles in the mainline Pokémon games. And there are some important aspects of Showdown that are worth noting. First, Showdown is free, open-source software, maintained, I presume here, by a volunteer staff, given that Showdown does not operate for profit, and indeed appears to have no source of revenue, save for some infrequent advertisements served via enthusiast gaming. Enough revenue, perhaps, to support servers and hosting, but not enough to pay even a single developer, never mind several. You'll note that I do make quite a few presumptions here. Well, this is because publicly available information on how Showdown is run is rather scant. I did reach out to the Showdown team, and I received a response from staff member Dwabblefet, which was helpful, but also carefully worded. And this discretion, as we will see, is part of what makes Showdown so successful in its survival. Showdown was first released back in October of 2011, meaning that Pokémon Showdown is 1 month older than The Elder Scrolls V, aka Skyrim. So Showdown has been around for a long, long time, especially considering that it is a Nintendo IP fan project. Showdown released the same year as Pokémon Black and White, which released in March of 2011 in the United States. Now, Showdown began with rather humble roots. It wasn't some attempt to make a better Pokémon, and it wasn't designed to supplant Pokémon in any way. Showdown was a simple battle simulator created by a then-amateur computer science student named Guanzhong Luo, who goes by the alias Zaro. The potential of Showdown was apparent right from the get-go, though, and less than a year after Showdown's release, in July of 2012, the competitive Pokemon battling community Smogon adopted Showdown for use in its own competitive tournaments and community functions. In my research, I found this old interview with Zarl in an issue of Smogon's now-defunct webzine. This interview occurred on or about December of 2012, and it has some truly delightful conversation that harkens back to a friendlier, less serious age of the internet. Take, for example, this exchange wherein the interviewer, Oglemi, asks Zarl what he aspires to be one day. Oglemi opens, "Is a programmer what you aspire to be one day?" To which Zarl responds, "I aspire to be... well, I clearly aspire to be a wizard. But more practically, I aspire to be an awesome developer making awesome things and making people happy using my software." Mission accomplished, I'd say. I love that answer, by the way. There's no "I want to be the head of a major software company," or "I want to work for Microsoft or Google," or "I want to be rich." It's "I want to make awesome things that make people happy." How could you not respect a person like that? Here's another anecdote from the interview that wrenched a chuckle out of me, wherein Zarl talks more about his aspirations of being a wizard and relates computer science to magic. And I quote, "One of the nice things about Pokemon Showdown is that it's written in an interpreted language, JavaScript, which means that I can write code to change it while it's still running. Once in the early days, Pokemon Showdown got overrun by Brazilians. So I set up an international server and wrote some code to go through every user, look at their IP to see if they were in Brazil, and if so, move them over to the international server. It felt like I was casting a teleport spell. It was magical." You heard that right. Zarl literally sent all of the Brazilians on Pokemon Showdown to the Shadow Realm. I hope you found that as funny as I did. And if you're a Brazilian who doesn't want to go to the Shadow Realm, well, have you heard about our sponsor, Surfshark? But there was something else in this interview that I found quite interesting, and that is Zarl's inspiration for Pokemon Showdown. You see, before Showdown, there was another Pokemon battle simulator known as Pokemon Online, and Pokemon Online did ostensibly everything that Showdown did at its inception, save for one key feature: the ability to replay battles in their entirety. Zarl himself even calls Pokemon Showdown the replay player when he speaks about showing off Showdown in the Smogon and Pokemon Online forums for the first time. Pokemon Online existed at the same time as Pokemon Showdown. PONline released back in March of 2010 and ran until the project was shut down on August 28, 2021. Not due to any legal strike from Nintendo or the Pokemon Company, but due to a lack of funding and activity in the face of the now far more successful Showdown. But let's talk for a bit about the success of Showdown and what that means. If you're watching this video, you likely already know how successful Showdown is. You might have seen Temp6T troll a tryhard into an aneurysm using only a Dunsparce. You might have seen Wolfie VGC playing Showdown in any number of videos or streams. Showdown is both ubiquitous and popular. There's basically no accessing the competitive Pokemon battling scene without access to Showdown. And if we consider where Showdown is today relative to Zarl's goals of making awesome things that make people happy, well, then Showdown is a tremendous success. What Showdown isn't, though, is a financial success. Showdown is a platform for the people. It remains mostly unmonetized, it doesn't advertise or promote itself, and most importantly, it knows how not to rock the boat. It knows how to let its merits speak for themselves, and thus can exist in the zone of comfortable IP ignorance. Or even, dare I suggest, cooperation. What am I talking about exactly? Well, let's move on from discussing Showdown itself, and talk now a bit about law and business. I've spoken at length about IP law before in previous videos, and if there's one thing I'd like for you to take away from all of those videos, it's this. Modern international intellectual property law is incredibly flawed and serves the interests of nobody, not the IP holders and not the consumers. My European viewers are often quite surprised to discover that the license agreements they are subject to are not altogether that different from the ones in the United States or the ones in Japan. That despite local rules, IP holders often choose to implement more severe license agreements than they need to, often to their own detriment. Well, this is because international IP law has largely been standardized as a result of various treaties. There's the Budapest Treaty, the Hague Agreement, the Patent Cooperation Treaty, the Patent Law Treaty, and the UPOV Convention, all of which govern patents. There's the Trademark Law Treaty, the Singapore Treaty on the Law of Trademark, and the Madrid Protocol with respect to trademarks. And with regards to copyright and IP as a whole, there is the Berne Convention, the Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights Agreement, better known as the TRIPS Agreement, and the WIPO Copyright Treaty, amongst others. Now, international cooperation to standardize intellectual property law is a good thing. The problem is, technology moves quickly and the law does not. The Berne Convention, the foundation upon which the entirety of modern international IP law is built, was signed in 1886. And the TRIPS Agreement, which builds upon the Berne Convention with an eye towards the digital age, was signed in 1994. The WIPO Copyright Treaty was signed in 1996. And despite clarifications like the Doha Declaration or the Beijing Treaty on Audiovisual Performances or the Marrakesh Treaty, the law is always playing catch-up with technology. This is all relevant for three interconnected reasons. Number one, these treaties in trying to establish a universal IP standard for trade are necessarily vague, which leaves a lot of room for legal interpretation. Number two, the language in these treaties means that all parties engaging in international trade must act in accordance with the laws of the largest economic player in the room, that being the United States, which is a problem because number three, the United States has done a terrible job plugging in the gaps that these treaties purposefully leave open, thus making everything regarding intellectual property law far more ambiguous and unclear than it has any need to be. Consider, for example, the fair use doctrine in the United States. In the U.S., we have a four-factor test that is used to determine what counts as a fair use of someone else's intellectual property. A court weighs, number one, the purpose and character of the use. Number two, the nature of the copyrighted work. Number three, the amount and substantiality of the work taken or copied. And number four, the use's economic impact upon the work, including the effect on potential markets. What does any of this mean? Well, you can argue about it by reading what interpretations have emerged in case law. How weak of a factor 3 do you need to overcome an otherwise strong factor 2? Well, you do your research, you trust your gut, and you make a strong argument based on your prior cases and what other cases have held. When are you supposed to assert fair use? So you can't just declare fair use whenever you like, it's an affirmative defense, meaning that your chance to assert fair use only comes up when you've already been taken to court. Now let's be clear, fair use is a good thing, but the applicability is limited as an affirmative defense. The outcome is subject to an open-ended test with broad ambiguous factors, and thus, the public, by and large, doesn't understand how fair use works, and successfully utilizing fair use requires one to participate in expensive litigation. The ambiguity created in American IP law, then, an ambiguity that is Congress's job to fix, means that both consumers and IP holders have to wander through a legal minefield when handling anything involving intellectual property. And nowhere is this ambiguity more deadly than the subsection of intellectual property law, that is, trademark law. Almost nothing in law is black and white, or for that matter, red and blue, or diamond and pearl. Now think about it in this way. If a copyright is the exclusive right given to an IP holder to make copies of and distribute their works, the trademark is like the branding of that work. This work is Pokémon Shield. Nintendo / Creatures Inc. / Game Freak have the copyright, so they can reproduce and distribute this work. The trademark is Pokémon, the branding. Both are a part of the work and are two different intellectual property rights. The legal ambiguity that exists when it comes to trademarks, though, means that trademarks are notoriously flimsy. You can actually lose your trademark, for example, if you allow your trademark to become generic. If everyone's collective mothers calls every game system a Nintendo such that it enters into common parlance, the Nintendo trademark itself could be lost. But you can also lose your trademark if you fail to control permission for others to use your trademark. This is called naked licensing. A trademark owner has an affirmative duty to ensure the consistency of its trademarks and the quality of the goods under which its trademarks are used. And indeed, a trademark owner can engage in naked licensing even if they don't give a licensee permission to use the license, by merely permitting or consenting to use of a trademark in an indirect fashion. If you know other entities are using your trademark and you are failing to stop them, you could be both consenting to their use and thereby engaging in naked licensing. If you don't maintain exclusive control of your mark, you don't get to have it. Your trademark has something of an invisible health bar, and when damage occurs to your trademark causing its HP to drop, this chip damage is called trademark dilution. These little chips of failing to enforce trademark rights can weaken the distinctiveness and strength of those trademarks over time, notwithstanding potential brand control or management issues that may arise on the marketing or business side of things, which we'll also get to. This may not be quite as big of a deal for a smaller company with a less valuable trademark that has lesser notoriety. But if you possess one of the world's most valuable trademarks, one of the world's most valuable, if not the world's most valuable brand, a brand that every other player in the game is looking to gobble up at the first sign of weakness, then you'd also want to protect it as much as possible, given the incredible ambiguity present in the system. Now, of course, this is an extreme oversimplification for your benefit and mine. I found that there's a fine line to walk when it comes to legal deep dives in these videos. If you'd prefer a deeper dive into specific statutes or case law, let me know, and perhaps we can revisit this in the future for the millionth time or so. In any case, the result of this ambiguity and potential for enormous loss is that each company is left to interpret the law in its own way, adopting some position in a spectrum of allowability that often tracks with the value of one's intellectual property. The more valuable your property, the more defensive of a posture you are naturally incentivized to take. Disney, for example, has historically been quite strict with control over its intellectual property because it is a company that survives due to its brands. Disney is, functionally, a brand management company, and thus any damage to the edifice of its foundation, any loss of brand control or worse, intellectual property control, no matter how slight, cannot really be afforded. We've discussed before how Sega isn't like Disney in that way. How Sega Sammy has priorities outside of brand management in that, in fact, the utility of its brands are as much about protecting its image for its other business ventures as they are valuable in them of themselves. Which is to say, Sega Sammy isn't going to police your Sonic fan game because losing a little bit of brand control and maybe even a little bit of intellectual property control is okay, as the goodwill is more valuable to the corporation than the amount of control ceded to the fans. However, Sega Sammy is absolutely not above pulling the reins in when certain thresholds are crossed. When behaviors cross the invisible line, it is set in the spectrum of allowability, as we've seen with Sega Sammy's non-Sonic the Hedgehog properties and, well, increasingly also with Sonic the Hedgehog, as the value of the brand itself rises relative to the value of the goodwill. The calculus is thus rather cold and cynical. Make no mistake, virtually no corporation is doing anything for the consumer's benefit alone, not even the ones you ostensibly like. And if they say they are now, maybe due to present consumer-friendly leadership, understand this. People can die, people can move on, but corporations are forever. Nintendo has found itself in an increasingly Disney-like position, where a substantial amount of its profit comes not necessarily from the sale of games or consoles, but from the successful management of intellectual property. This has especially been the case in the post-Iwata era. Iwata was a game developer turned businessman. Miyamoto was also a dev turned businessman, and even Nintendo affiliates like Sakurai over at HAL Labs was a dev turned businessman. But the new leadership of Nintendo, they are businessmen through and through. Which, I will note, is not necessarily a bad thing. The good brand management that comes with more sophisticated business know-how gives us consumers things we love, like Nintendo World, or the Mario movie, or the post-2019 International Pokemon Centers, and more. And indeed, as we'll later discuss, it is already the case that Nintendo's largest source of income comes not from the selling of games or consoles, but the selling of merchandise and experiences based on their brands. This doesn't mean that the games aren't important. The games drive interest and build the brand, not unlike how Disney movies or TV shows build various Disney brands. And because Nintendo's value is increasingly stored in its brands, protection of said brands, of said intellectual property, becomes paramount, even if the cost is some goodwill. You will notice, though, that there is still a cost here. It's not that Nintendo takes some kind of perverse joy in pummeling fan projects or emulators into the dirt. It, as any corporate entity does, understands that these unpopular decisions have costs. It's just by their calculus, the potential damage something like an emulator can do, or taken to the next level of danger, ROMs can do, to both intellectual property strength and brand control is potentially way worse than the publicity hit taken by affirmatively pursuing action against those things. Armed now with some basic knowledge of IP law, it's time to take a look at what especially skittish IP holders like Nintendo, or for that matter Sony or Microsoft or Capcom or even Sega, might look out for. Let's say you are working on a fan project. What allows some projects to fly under the radar, and what makes some projects threatening enough to smash with seemingly disproportionate force? The answer is your conduct. The problem is, game devs and fan artists, by and large, aren't lawyers, and the law is both vague and confusing even for lawyers. So let's see if we can lift the veil a little bit. An IP holder cares about unauthorized use of their IP for two overarching reasons. The first reason is legal control over their property, and the second is business control over their property. If you can avoid them being both a legal concern and a brand control concern, you are less likely to be targeted for enforcement action. It's almost a bit silly. The corporation has to interpret how it thinks the PTO slash courts will interpret the infringing behavior, and thereby the corporation reacts according to its interpretation. On the legal side of things, remember that corporations are afraid for the integrity of their brands. As such, you want to make sure that if you insist on using someone else's intellectual property, even within the scope of purported fair use, that you try to avoid behaviors which could damage that legal integrity. Now, a trademark has to be both used in commerce and be distinctive in order to be valid. Instead of going through case law and rules, let's make things simple and take a look at what these standards look like from the corporate side. There are rules and standards that the PTO slash courts use to determine whether such a trademark is indeed used in commerce and distinctive enough. These standards aren't clear, as we've noted, and the severity of each standard exists on a sliding scale, a spectrum. Thus, while I can make a list based on my understanding, the ambiguity means that an entity or court could interpret these criteria differently and weigh some heavier than others. With regards to video games and fan works, though, I think that this list is pretty robust. Here's what to avoid on the legal side, starting with number one, the big one. Don't make too much money. Are you profiting off of your fan work? Remember from before that allowing someone to profit off of your trademark when you're aware of their profiting from it without your permission is akin to naked licensing. If you aren't in control of your trademark and it isn't exclusive, then you aren't meeting your affirmative duty to ensure the consistency of your trademark and thus you don't get to have it. This criterion, like all the other criteria, exists on a sliding scale. If you're producing stickers of Vaporeon fan art to sell at your local comic con, you aren't likely making loads of cash. For this and other reasons we'll look at, your infringement is not likely to warrant legal attention. If you draw commissioned fan art of a prurient variety and are making thousands selling unbecoming pictures of said Vaporeon, then this becomes a much bigger issue, as the money you are making is a more severe unlicensed use of the IP on the legal side of things, given the volume of your business, and because your use damages the image of the brand on the business side of things. A fun fact, if you make fan art using the Pokemon IP, you've already given the Pokemon Company slash Nintendo a royalty-free, non-exclusive, irrevocable, transferable, sub-licensable, and worldwide license to use your fan art for any purpose. In any case, if your business volume gets to the point where you could be Yuzu Emulator or Piracy Group Team Executor, making literal millions off of someone else's IP, you might be seen as an existential threat, and thus an extreme enforcement priority. If you make no money, then your fan work starts to look much more like fair use, or at the very least, a relatively harmless infringement that can be easily overlooked. Your infringement could even be marginally beneficial to the brand, something we'll explore more in the business section of this chapter. Which brings us then to criterion 2. Don't copy the essence of a work. What does this mean? Well, let's say you're considering making a fan work based on Sonic the Hedgehog. The closer your fan work resembles what the Sonic brand fundamentally purports to be, which is to say a video game series, the more dangerous it is to the trademark, and thus the more likely one is to invite legal action, usually under the guise of a copyright action to protect that trademark. A fan game that looks just like Sonic, plays just like Sonic, uses actual sprites and assets from Sonic games, and is indistinguishable from a Sonic product, can lead to consumer confusion, and if no action is taken, it starts to look like naked licensing. If someone else has made a Sonic game that is so similar to your own that it could cause confusion to the average buyer, you may risk dilution or damage to your trademark. Meanwhile, mere fan art is almost harmless and thus usually allowed. If you aren't using actual Sonic game assets and you're drawing your own art, you are arguably using the essence of the work to a limited degree. Somewhere in between the fan art of Donut Steel you're putting up on your DeviantArt page and that complete Sonic fan game with asset rips might be something like a Chow Garden fan game with homemade assets, which I can't believe nobody has made yet. Chow Garden is an aspect of the Sonic Adventure series, but it is detached enough that I'd argue that it isn't quite as severe an infringement as making a Sonic clone fan game with Sega-owned assets. Now, this is all a little bit moot, as Sega, and also largely Nintendo, aren't actually that picky about the essence of the game issue, and care much more about the money-making criterion. By using their assets, you've already surrendered ownership of your fan work to them anyhow. Nevertheless, if you wish to minimize the negative attention you receive with your fan work, essence is still something to consider. Consider also that the reverse might be true if you're making fan art of, say, a comic series. If you're drawing comics that use someone else's IP and selling those comics, that might be a more serious IP infringement for a comic producer than, say, a fan video game of the IP made using your original assets. Make no mistake, though, these examples are all likely to be in some respect copyright and/or trademark infringement. Recall again that fair use is not some blanket protection, it's an affirmative defense. It's like how you can only use Whirlwind to escape a battle once that battle has begun. Until then, you're still wandering around in tall grass, and a Poké lawsuit could pop up at any time. And not unlike a Pokémon in tall grass, your goal should be, ostensibly, to stay hidden, which brings us to Criterion 3. Don't promote your work. If you don't want to end up as experience points for the corporate Dragonite, don't pop out of the tall grass. Look, I get it. Everyone wants their fan project to be successful. It feels good to receive praise and recognition for something you've built. And if you're especially foolhardy, it might even feel good to rake in some cash while you're at it. But if you go out of your way to promote your fan project and make it a big deal, this is akin to openly challenging the IP holder to a licensing fight. It's putting a big, gleaming billboard above your fan work that legally screams, "Hey, I'm diluting your trademark." The more notorious and further reaching your fan work is, the more dangerous it is, especially if you are boisterous in your self-promotion. Sure, sometimes things get popular and travel by word of mouth. There are fan projects upon which entire fandoms rely, like the Mother 3 fan localization that all Western Mother 3 fans have to use to play the game. Or, well, like, you know, Pokémon Showdown and the competitive Pokémon scene. But the extent of these projects doesn't kill them because they aren't self-aggrandizing. Let's take a look at an example of how not to handle Criterion 3. There was an article not long ago about a scanned strategy guide from 1996 being taken down by Nintendo. Take a look. Why on earth does Nintendo care about scans of a 1996 Super Mario strategy guide? This thing has never been sold in the West, and it hasn't been for sale in decades. What money could Nintendo possibly stand to lose here? Well, it wasn't about the strategy guide per se, but in how it was made so widely available to the public. This specific strategy guide scan was huge on Twitter, and it was an extremely highly upvoted post on Reddit. It had articles written about it in various large video game publications, all seemingly out of nowhere. If those scans had been kept on the lowdown, stashed in a video game archival site or something, then even if Nintendo had noticed that they existed, it's likely no action would have been taken. It's this, "everyone look at this cool thing I found" kind of behavior, using a Nintendo trademarked and copyrighted asset and claiming it as one's own find, that makes this particular scan of a strategy guide so threatening. Sure, the notoriety and publicity is what allowed so many people to discover these scans, but that same notoriety and publicity here surrounding a scanned reproduction of Nintendo's copyrighted strategy guide, brimming with its trademarks, is a potential legal landmine in an ambiguous legal battlefield. Does that make sense? If you are taking an extremely defensive posture in hopes of guarding especially precious IP, you might also choose to be this protective. In spite of that, however, as we discussed, I think that many internet pundits mistook the takedown of this strategy guide as being solely a matter of the fourth criterion, which is, don't affect the market. If you're going to make a fan work, don't make something that takes market share away from the IP holder. This isn't for the reason you might think it is, at least not entirely. It's not about how much profit your Sonic fan game might be taking away from Sega. It's about Sega having a competitor in the marketplace using Sega's intellectual property against it. Even if the fan game isn't making any money, even if the fan game isn't very good, if it is giving even a handful of potential Sonic game buyers a dose of Sonic sufficient enough that they aren't buying a real Sonic game, then you're permitting a potential market competitor to compete with you using a trademark that you're supposed to control. And if you aren't in control of the trademark to the level where someone is competing against you using your trademark, what's the point of you having it? Where's the benefit to the market? Naturally, the more potential harm to the market any fan work represents, the greater the danger is, and the more likely a legal action is to occur. The point of these legal actions may not even necessarily be to win. They just have to make a show of force because the ambiguity of the law makes such shows of force necessary to convince the PTO and courts that you're doing your due diligence. You'll note that these four criteria, when put together, look an awful lot like the criteria for fair use. And indeed, fair use is basically just a loophole made law over time through judicial interpretation. If your use isn't rising to the point where it could arbitrarily cause some IP harm, then it's fine. But you have to prove that it's fine as a defense. Like fair use, our criteria for legal action are weighed together, and the inflection point, the point where action is deemed necessary, differs from IP holder to IP holder. In any case, before we move on to the business side, let's take a look at a perfect example of what not to do by looking backwards at Yuzu Emulator. As a reminder, here's our four criteria. Number one, don't make too much money. Number two, don't copy the essence of a work. Number three, don't promote your work. And number four, don't affect the market. On criterion one, Yuzu was soliciting donations via Patreon and pulled in around $1 million in addition to selling access to premium builds capable of running certain games at release date. Thus, one can confidently say that Yuzu was making substantial profit in its operations. Number two, what was Yuzu creating? Was it copying the essence of a work? Well, yes, it was creating an emulator, a literal recreation of a console capable of playing ROMs. Even its logo was derivative of a Nintendo trademark. There are some foibles to all this, though, which you can learn about in the Yuzu emulator video and in the prior videos I've done on emulation. But to simplify things greatly, Yuzu was copying the essence of a work by Nintendo's calculus. Number three, was Yuzu promoting its work? Well, at its peak popularity, Yuzu was literally the second highest grossing Patreon page on the entire games category of Patreon, raking in nearly $30,000 per month. Yuzu was widely promoted on Reddit, on various emulation forums, and all over YouTube. As such, Yuzu was extremely visible and being heavily pushed by its developers. And finally, criterion 4. What was Yuzu's impact on the potential market? Well, given that Yuzu made highly anticipated games like Tears of the Kingdom available to pirate shortly after the game's release, and given the enormous spike in Yuzu patrons on Patreon paying for the premium version of the emulator to access a premium build capable of playing Tears of the Kingdom, the impact was not insignificant. Moreover, emulators generally represent something of an existential threat to video game developers. For the record, I'm not saying that I think these fan-made non-industry emulators are an existential threat. But the large game developers, the large game publishers, by and large, do. So weighing the criteria together, we can see that Yuzu basically did everything wrong, everything one shouldn't do, to avoid being sued. They made a lot of money, they copied the essence of the work, they promoted their work heavily, and they had a potentially significant impact on the market. Now it can be argued that the essence of the work actually taken is quite limited, but the severity of the other three criteria trump the weakness of this one criterion. So why is Ryujinx alive for now and Yuzu dead? Well, now you know, in part. In just a bit, we'll run these same criteria past Pokemon Showdown to see how it does everything right. But first, let's talk about the other side of this equation, the side that internet pundits often conflate with the legal side, which is the business side. The realms of law and business often butt heads. In a large corporation, legal is often the department putting the brakes on everything fun and keeping their heads on a swivel. They're the ones on the lookout for potential liability, infringement, leakers, etc. The marketing department and brand management slash control, they have different priorities. And for them, cultivating goodwill amongst their consumer base is critical to their work. You can bet that the powers that be are fully aware of how a DMCA or a lawsuit affects how gamers perceive their company. Sega's marketing folks have literally used their less litigious reputation to promote the Sonic brand in the past, for example. But just as important as keeping a positive consumer perception of your brand is, so too is keeping one's brand control tight and strong. Imagine the consumer base as a target that you're trying to hit with a laser. The laser is your brand, the message you're trying to target the consumer with. If your product is a big hit with your consumer base, we'll say that you've scored a bullseye. If your product doesn't resonate with the consumers, then you've missed the target. That's one consideration. But once you've hit the bullseye, it becomes important to maintain the focus and direction of the laser. You can neither allow the laser to wander from the target nor become diffused by anything in the way. That's brand management, brand control. And the more control one cedes to other parties who are using your brand without permission, the more diffuse or misdirected that tight beam becomes. Sure, sometimes a company deviates or deflects that beam a little on purpose to see if there are other targets they can hit. They purposefully split the beam a little, reducing the core message, but potentially striking more valuable bullseyes in other markets. Disney brands, for example, have long been parodied or unlawfully utilized in streetwear in an ironic sense, long before the stuff became so mainstream. But Disney saw an opportunity there, and as streetwear has gone from once vulgar to hip to increasingly pedestrian, Disney followed along, selling its brands in the form of family-friendly streetwear. That's Disney wrestling the focus of their laser away from people diffusing their beam. The late 90s gangsta Mickey Mouse and Friends hoodie, which is a serious deviation from the positive image Disney wants to cultivate for that brand, gave way to the much tamer, gentrified stuff we see today, which comes from Disney itself in the form of licensed merch. And thus, when we consider usage of someone else's IP from the brand management side, we must always ask ourselves, well, what is the brand? Because if we can figure out what the laser is targeting and what the focus of the laser is, we can also figure out how not to disrupt it and thus invite unwelcome attention upon ourselves. We can avoid uniting brand management and legal against us. Which brings us now finally to the analysis portion of the video, where we take a look at each of our criteria for legal as well as brand management concerns as they pertain to Pokémon Showdown. I'll start with brand management since that's freshest in our memory. Let me ask you, what is Pokémon? Not literally what is a Pokémon, but what is Pokémon? The trademark, the brand. What is being sold to you, the consumer? What about Pokémon is important by Nintendo's calculus? And yes, I do mean Nintendo. Look at the game box of any Pokémon game you own. Who owns the trademarks? Unless you are in Japan, why, it's Nintendo. And as we've seen with Nintendo's own leadership, the Pokémon Company and Nintendo proper are joined at the hip, with promotions directly occurring from one company into the next in a seamless manner. Make no mistake, Nintendo calls the shots. It's the head of the serpent. I cut like 10 minutes out of this video wherein I tediously explain the relationship between the Pokémon Company, Nintendo, Game Freak, and Creatures, Inc. If that sounds interesting to you, then, wow, we ought to get together and go ruin a party sometime. But to simplify things for all these sane people in the audience, I'll continue saying Nintendo as opposed to the Pokémon Company for clarity's sake. Sorry, so what about Pokémon is important by Nintendo's calculus? Is it the battling? Is it the adventure? What is it? Well, the answer has been hiding in front of us all along, and I quote, "I want to be the very best, like no one ever was. To catch them is my real test. To train them is my cause. I will travel across the land, searching far and wide. Teach Pokémon to understand the power that's inside. Pokémon, gotta catch them all." Right? Since the very beginning, the premise of Pokémon was catch them all, train them up, go on an adventure, make friends with your Pokémon, and eventually be the very best. But being the very best in Pokémon has never really been about battling your way to becoming the very best. The theme in the games and the anime that is constantly hammered into us is, unironically, that the real treasure was the friend we made along the way. That being the best can have different meanings. You can be the best water trainer. You can be the best Pokémon breeder. Being the best means not beating everyone else in battle necessarily, but befriending all the Pokémon. Collect Pokémon. Befriend Pokémon. Form bonds with your Pokémon through adventures and catch them all. This is where the laser is focused, and this is what allows Pokémon to strike the consumer target so cleanly. It's a very tightly controlled brand, and the message of collecting Pokémon, of befriending Pokémon, of seeing Pokémon less like collecting bugs or rocks or coins, and more like collecting friends, is exceptionally resonant to the consumer. Pokémon have different personalities, natures, right? Pokémon have genders, and you can nickname them, and you can form an emotional bond with them. And you know what? It works. It works big time. The entire Hello Kitty franchise has an estimated total revenue of $28.8 billion. Spider-Man has an estimated total revenue of $25.5 billion. But Pokémon's game sales, just the game sales, has brought in an estimated gross of $30 billion. This number alone would make Pokemon the 11th highest grossing media franchise of all time, just above Batman. But the revenue generated by game sales is utterly dwarfed by the real value of Pokemon, merchandise. The last revenue update provided by Nintendo itself in 2019 shows that Pokemon has grossed around $81 billion in licensed merchandise. The VG Sales Wiki, which has reliable sources that you can review for yourself, estimates that this number has since increased to over $100 billion as of 2023. That's a preposterous amount of money. Now, this is a false equivalence, I know, but this is just for fun. That number is $10 billion more than the market cap of the State Bank of India. Just Pokemon's merchandise sales are almost equal to the entirety of the gross revenue of the next two highest grossing media franchises put together. Mickey Mouse and Friends at $52 billion, and Winnie the Pooh at $48.5 billion, respectively. But of course, Pokemon is more than just merchandise or even game sales. There's the movies, the manga, music and anime, and of course, the trading card game. Pokemon's total gross revenue for a franchise that debuted in 1996 is estimated to be $150 billion. More false equivalence time, that's a gross revenue $34 billion larger than the market cap of Sony. That's $27 billion larger than the market cap of freaking BlackRock of Citigroup. Now look, obviously total gross revenue and market cap are meaningless to compare. Sony's annual gross revenue for 2023 was $85.3 billion, with earnings of $7.96 billion after expenses. But it's interesting to look at those figures as a way of gauging just how staggeringly large Pokemon's numbers truly are. Pokemon is selling you friends, selling you cute creatures, cool creatures, and other creatures. The battling is just one aspect, one minor aspect of the entire edifice, and the competitive side of the battling is like a fraction of that minor aspect. So let's take a look at Pokemon Showdown. Showdown is a battle simulator. You cannot go on an adventure with your Pokemon in Showdown. You can't go to Kanto or Johto or Hoenn or Unova. You can't be forced to spend 10 minutes walking back to a Pokemon Center because you chose Squirtle as your starter and thereby need to pull your Sandshrew or Bellsprout out of storage to cut a shrub. You cannot catch them all. You cannot train them as your cause. You cannot travel across the land searching far and wide, and you cannot teach Pokemon to understand the power that's inside. What you can do is battle. And if battling is important to you, you can also be the very best, like no one ever was, at battling, which we are taught over and over is not the point of Pokemon. Sure, the game rolls credits when you've fought and beaten the Elite Four and Champion, but even as early as Gen 1, the story doesn't end there. In the last episode of the Pokemon anime, after Ash has already ascended to become a champion of the Pokemon world, after all has been said and done, the great adventures had and the insurmountable odds conquered, Ash himself tells us what it truly means to be a Pokemon master. It's not about being the best battler, Ash conjectures to himself. Instead, being a Pokemon master means befriending every single Pokemon. The value of the Pokemon games isn't necessarily in the battling, it's just one facet of a much greater whole. And the value of Pokemon isn't necessarily in the games, that's also just one facet of a much greater whole. The value of Pokemon is the Pikachu alarm clock you had as a kid. The value of Pokemon is in the sleeping Galarian Ponyta plush you impulse bought while you were shopping for clothes in Taipei. The value of Pokemon is the urge to spend $2,400 on a Pokemon Colab Fendi purse, not because of how it looks, but because of how it makes you feel. To use Pokemon to understand the power that's inside. And as Pokemon Showdown interferes with none of that, it does not disrupt the laser's focus in a meaningful way. In fact, just considering here the business side of things, it may even be marginally beneficial to have Pokemon Showdown around, to engage this passionate subcommunity of your consumer base, of these largely adult players, without actually having to spend resources on it or develop a competitive scene that isn't what you want to build your brand around. An unspoken, or dare I suggest, potentially spoken and mutual but private agreement emerges. You're not diffusing our laser, your community is not our marketing focus, and you might even be beneficial bringing into the Pokemon fold interested fringe consumers. If you're willing to lay low, we're willing to look the other way for our mutual benefit. So on the brand management side of things, Pokemon Showdown's continued existence is a no-brainer. The complicated part, though, is the legal side. And here is where I think the cleverness of the Showdown team really shines through, because they are doing everything right. And if you want to start your own fan project, it may be worth it to see what Showdown is doing right and apply their practices to your own work. Do you remember our criteria from earlier? What should you avoid if you don't want to be targeted for IP infringement, but particularly where valuable trademarks are involved? Number one, don't make too much money. Number two, don't copy the essence of a work. Number three, don't promote your work. And number four, don't affect the market. Starting with criterion one, Pokemon Showdown makes no money. It's an open source fan project, and it has, to my knowledge, no Patreon, no donation page, nothing. It does run some ads served via Enthusiast Gaming. I presume, however, that this ad revenue is both quite low and also not used for development. It's probably used to finance the cost of the servers. Showdown is free to use. There's no premium, gatekept version of it being sold. Showdown is open source. One can mod it. One can help contribute to it. One can just take it to do whatever, provided that one adheres to the license agreement. And Showdown uses the MIT license, arguably the simplest and least problematic of any of the copyleft licenses. The whole MIT license is just four sentences long. Thus, if we ask ourselves, does Pokemon Showdown exist for a commercial purpose? Does it enrich Zarl or his devs? Does it make too much money? The answer is no to all of the above. As such, on even the most sensitive of IP infringement sliding scales, Showdown barely registers in this criterion. Criterion 2, Showdown doesn't copy the essence of the work. As we've already discussed, the heart of the Pokemon brand isn't the battling, it's the befriending. The Pokemon games are about adventuring and making friends with people and Pokemon alike. It's about defeating the mob, or environmentalists, or extra-dimensional jellyfish. Battling is a slice of that much, much, much greater whole, and I'd argue it's not a prioritized slice. Showdown, wisely, calls itself a battle simulator. It's not a Pokemon battler, implying some causal link between the Pokemon Company / Nintendo and Showdown. It is software that simulates a battle, and thus it does not strongly copy the essence of what Pokemon is. In this respect, then, Showdown is also non-threatening. Moving on, then, to Criterion 3. Showdown doesn't promote Showdown. It doesn't need to. Zarl introduced Showdown to Smogon, and Smogon adopted it. Again, you can't help but to admire the guy. He's not out for the glory. He's not out for the fame nor the riches. Zarl says, I want to make something that people will love. And yeah, people love it. There's no need to shout about Showdown from the rooftops or to self-aggrandize. Tons of you who have played Showdown probably haven't even heard of Zarl. I'd posit this is an important part of why Showdown succeeds and thrives and survives, when other projects of much smaller scale and scope do not. As Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu once said, when the master governs, the people are hardly aware that he exists. The master doesn't talk, he acts. When his work is done, the people say, amazing, we did it all by ourselves. Wise indeed. And finally, we get to Criterion 4. Showdown doesn't affect the market. Pokemon makes $100 billion in merchandise. Pokemon sells $30 billion in games. Has Showdown negatively impacted those numbers whatsoever? I think a very strong argument can be made that Showdown has potentially never caused a measurable sale to be lost, and in fact, has potentially even driven additional interest in the franchise as a whole. That Showdown has boosted Pokemon sales, albeit marginally, by providing a platform that supports the competitive Pokemon community. A community largely consisting of adults, thus maintaining the long-term interest of these adults in Pokemon as a franchise, as a brand. Wolfie can act as marketing to places where corporate marketing can't reach. And in this way, the Pokemon Company can keep this community invested in Pokemon without going off-brand themselves. So if we take all of these criteria and weigh them together, we come away with a very carefully put-together project that is both a minimal threat to intellectual property rights and a minimal threat to brand control, while also producing some fringe, marginal benefits that are ultimately advantageous to the brand. Consider as well, enforcement always has a cost, a monetary cost, and a popularity cost. If Showdown is this apparently harmless, then what's the incentive to spend the money and lose the popularity? In the cost-benefit analysis, there is no good incentive, and if there is no good incentive to axe Showdown, then it never happens, and Showdown gets to chug along, making people happy. But make no mistake, If there isn't some IP use agreement in place, which I have some reason to believe that there might be on the hush-hush, Showdown is chock-full of IP infringement. If Nintendo or the Pokemon Company wanted to, they absolutely could sue. Remember again, even fair use is a mere affirmative defense in court. More likely than not, if Showdown did receive a DMCA takedown request, it'd have no choice but to comply instead of fighting it out. But again, there's just no good reason to do that. I reached out to the team at Pokemon Showdown, you will recall, and received a reply from staff member DeWobblefett, who states succinctly, broadly, our rule of thumb is don't upset TPCI. The Pokemon Company International. That's a good rule, if you ask me. DeWobblefett continues by stating that they take care not to charge for anything on site, including incentives or donations. That they prohibit discussion of illegal activity on their forums or elsewhere, and they like to keep a positive image. Again, making sure not to diffuse that brand control laser in any way. This question has also come up on the Smogon forums proper, where it has been alleged that Showdown has communicated with the entities that own Pokemon, going so far as to have even been granted permission by said entities to use the battle music that Showdown uses. So maybe there's been some communication and cooperation. And that's a good thing. Discretion is the better part of valor. And cooperation with the IP holders is ultimately the best way to keep your fan project alive. You don't need any of this analysis if you have tacit permission. And while I can't tell you whether or not Showdown has explicit permission from Nintendo / the Pokemon Company, it does seem that these agreements exist in some capacity, which only helps to support Showdown's longevity. It's likely in both Nintendo / the Pokemon Company and Showdown's best interest not to disclose any working relationship. It's clear then, given all that we've seen, that the folks at Showdown know what they're doing. Their selflessness in holding up the entire competitive Pokemon scene on their shoulders like some Poke Atlas is deeply commendable. And if you want to start your own fan project, no matter the IP, well, Pokemon Showdown is a great example to learn from. Everybody wants to be a master. Everybody wants to show their skill. Everybody wants to get there faster, make their way to the top of the hill. But if you're going to use someone else's intellectual property on the way up to the top of said hill, understand that there are both risks and consequences involved in that use. And look, I get it. The law isn't clear about what is and isn't allowed. That's why lawyers exist, right? We fight over these nitty-gritty interpretations of law which were written for an analog world in the digital age, made by judges who can't log into a computer and whose clerks are still forced to use WordPerfect like it's 1998. Which, coincidentally, is when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, was passed. The DMCA was signed 1 month after the foundation of Google. American IP law is primitive, it is antiquated, it is confusing, it serves nobody's interests well, and it is desperately in need of reform. But this is the world that we live in, and as long as the rules exist, we either have to play by those rules or accept the risks. Pokemon Showdown survives. It thrives because it understands the rules. The leadership knows the boundaries, and they've navigated the fjord with precision. Don't make money. Don't copy the essence of a work. Don't promote, and don't affect the market. Oh, and a secret bonus tip, maybe try communicating. You'd be surprised to learn how willing some of these companies are, including Nintendo, including the Pokemon Company, to cooperate. But here's a corollary for you. I stumbled upon this article on Aftermath, where an interviewer Luke Plunkett questions Pokemon's former chief lawyer Don McGowan on the topic of fan games. Don has a great line in the interview, in which he paraphrases Clausewitz, stating, "Litigation is the continuation of PR by other means." On the topic of how cease and desist letters end up being served to fan projects, Don has this to say. How do fan projects get C&D'd? And I quote, "Short answer, thanks to you folks," referring here to the video game journalists. I would be sitting in my office minding my own business when someone from the company would send me a link to a news article, or I would stumble across it myself. I teach entertainment law at the University of Washington and say this to my students. The worst thing on earth is when your fan project gets press, because now I know about you. Luke responds simply, "Oh. Oh no." Don continues then by stating, but that's not the end of the equation. You don't send a takedown right away. You wait to see if they get funded for a Kickstarter or similar. If they get funded, then that's when you engage. No one likes suing fans. So there you have it. That's two of our four criteria right there, and an implied warning, perhaps, that communication isn't necessarily the best decision for every fan project out there. It's like an IP Dark Forest hypothesis. You better make sure you're reaching out to the right alien civilization, or you might wind up extinct. So why hasn't Pokémon Showdown been axed? Why hasn't it been pulled up from its roots? Well, it's because Showdown isn't a tree or a weed. It's a flower. And thus, it avoids the legal forester's axe and receives instead his admiration. I've been your host, Mooney. I cut a lot of content out of this video to keep it simple, but I hope that everything was still clear and understandable in spite of this. A playlist with all of this video's music is in the description. Please go and show your love to the good folks at Silva Gunner. A special thanks to Larita Shine for the thumbnail and beautiful art, to Gaku Metasetta for the credits gag you're about to enjoy, to all of Moon Channel's generous patrons for making these videos possible, and thank you for tuning in to Moon Channel.
The end is near, and when I win, you and your friends will be trapped here.
What do you mean by that?
Ha! Just look around you, you fools. We've been dueling in the Shadow Realm. I transported us here when I first arrived. What do you think?
What are those things?
Those are lost souls, trapped forever in the darkness. And soon you will join them. Your souls doomed to wander in the darkness of the Shadow Realm.
No!